underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In Jennifer Egan's new novel, Manhattan Beach, Anna Carrigan works at the Brooklyn Naval Yard during World War II, where women are allowed to hold jobs that once belonged to men, including the dangerous and exclusive job of naval diver that Anna craves. One evening in a nightclub, she meets Dexter Stiles and begins to understand why her father vanished years before. In 2011, Jennifer Egan won the Pulitzer Prize for her novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad. Years before that book came out, she had begun researching the 1930s and 40s in New York City. Manhattan Beach is the result of that research, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jennifer Egan to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for asking me.
At what point did you think, as I mentioned, you'd been doing this research for a while, that it was time to take it on, that it was time to actually put that research to the use in the writing of the novel?
Well, I think I was putting off that date because I began A Visit from the Goon Squad actually as a kind of distraction or procrastination technique because I felt hesitant to begin Manhattan Beach. And I think the reason for that is that I had an inkling of how hard it was going to be to write this book, and I wanted to delay that experience. So anyway, after Goon Squad came out and I spent a couple of years just trying to capitalize on the good luck that that book had, you know, it was sort of a now or never moment. I mean, I'd been researching, you know, in a kind of desultory experiential way, let's say, since about 2005. Now it was 2012. You know, I had to get going. So I sat down and started writing. And in a way, the hardest work really began then, even research-wise, because I really don't know what my stories or my characters will be until I start writing. And I learn a lot about the book. In fact, all the important things in the course of writing the first draft. So once I started writing and had a sense of where the story was going to go and who would be in it, the most concentrated research began then.
But you knew the time period. You were interested in that time period.
I was interested in New York during World War II very much, and I just had a kind of curiosity about what it was like to be here at that time. I think looking at it analytically, a lot of that probably originated from 9/11, when New York felt like a war zone overnight. And it led me and many others to reflect back on what the city must have been like during the war when there was such a fear of an air or a sea invasion. And I think, too, 9/11 made me reflect on American global power and what had been some of the results of that power and how that power had first amassed, which really was during World War II and after. So all of those things made me curious about the city at that time. And curiosity is always my driving force in writing fiction.
And I would assume the ocean as well. The ocean plays such a large role in this novel that it seems that you are looking to describe and understand that power of the ocean.
Very true. I mean, I've always been pretty mesmerized by the ocean. I think that is partly just due to my background because I'm from Chicago originally, which is very dominated by Lake Michigan, which is really like an ocean. And then I grew up in San Francisco, which is virtually surrounded by water. And with all the elevations in that city, all the hills, one is just constantly aware of water. But in fact, what really led me to the water with this book was as soon as I began looking at even just at images of New York during World War II, what was so striking was that everything inclined out toward the edges of the city, as opposed to now where all the action is inside the city. And it was so stark a difference between that time before air travel was so common and nowadays when, you know, we don't necessarily think much about the water. But the story of New York during World War II was the story of a port. And most of the Atlantic East Coast convoys left from New York Harbor. And the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which is on the harbor, is, you know, part of the harbor, was the largest builder and repairer of Allied ships during the war. And of course, a lot of the war was fought at sea. So all of those things made my more almost spiritual, I guess, excitement about the sea very literal and tactical in this book.
I would love for you to read a bit from Manhattan Beach. You'll read from something from the beginning of the novel, and I'll let you set it up.
Sure. So you mentioned that that Anna, as an adult, a young adult, meets a kind of nightclub impresario named Dexter Stiles, whom she suspects may know something about her father's disappearance years before. I'm going to read a brief scene about when Anna first meets Dexter Stiles when she's a little girl and goes with her father to visit him at his home on Manhattan Beach in the winter. And Anna's job is to entertain Dexter Stiles' daughter, Tabitha, while Dexter Stiles and her father discuss some sort of business that we never quite understand. The two men come and find Anna and the other little girl on the beach, and Anna has waded into the water in the cold, which clearly makes her father unhappy. But Dexter Stiles is very curious about it. Mr. Stiles looked younger than her father, without shadows or creases in his face. She sensed an alertness about him, a humming tension perceptible even through his billowing overcoat. He seemed to await something to react to or be amused by. Right now, that something was Anna. Mr. Stiles crouched beside her on the sand and looked directly into her face. "Why the bare feet?" he asked. "Don't you feel the cold, or are you showing off?" Anna had no ready answer. It was neither of those, more an instinct to keep Tabby awed and guessing. But even that she couldn't articulate. "Why would I show off?" she said. "I'm nearly 12. "Well, what's it feel like?" She smelled mint and liquor on his breath, even in the wind. It struck her that her father couldn't hear their conversation. "It only hurts at first," she said. "After a while, you can't feel anything." Mr. Stiles grinned as if her reply were a ball he'd taken physical pleasure in catching. "Words to live by," he said, then rose again to his immense height. "She's strong," he remarked to Anna's father. "So she is." Her father avoided her eyes. Mr. Stiles brushed sand from his trousers and turned to go. He'd exhausted that moment and was looking for the next. "They're stronger than we are," Anna heard him say to her father. "Lucky for us, they don't know it." She thought he might turn and look back at her, but he must have forgotten.
Jennifer Egan reading from the new novel Manhattan Beach, published by Scribner. You talked a moment ago about that as this process comes, that you start with a time period and the characters grow out of that. At what point did you become interested in the divers and of a woman diver?
A lot of that had actually happened before I started writing, and it grew right out of my interest in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Because as soon as I began looking at the many different kinds of industrial work that were done there, and just to put it in context, the Brooklyn Navy Yard repaired some 5,000 Allied ships during the war and built 17 battleships. But unbeknownst to me, diving was an important part of ship repair. Ships were examined from underneath, you know, while they were still in the water by divers, and lots of decisions were made about what needed to happen to repair them based on what the divers saw. And the divers also patched hulls and did other repair work from underneath, as well as salvage work of pulling things out of the bay and the harbor that needed to come out. So I read a reminiscence by a civilian diver who had worked at the yard, a male, about his work, and it was fascinating to me. And even more than just a kind of wonky curiosity about that, just the sight of the old Mark V diving dress, which anyone would recognize. It's the iconic cylindrical helmet and the lead belt and the huge boots. Just the sight of that quickened something in me that I've really learned to pay attention to, because it means that something is going to lead somewhere in my fiction. So I got interested there. And then as I spent some time with Army veteran divers who were incredibly helpful to me in working on this book. I attended a reunion that they have every other year. So first of all, I was able to wear the Mark V, which was a pretty incredible experience, a 200-pound diving dress. But I also met a gentleman who had dived during World War II in Cherbourg, helping to clear the harbor after the Germans blew stuff up to keep the Allies from using the harbor. And I asked him, his name was Jim Kennedy, if he had ever met a female diver. And he said only one in his wartime career in Cherbourg, and she was Russian, which made sense because the Russian women did everything. They were pilots and doctors, and they saw combat. I was intrigued by that. Of course, the war was a time when in America, women did all kinds of jobs they'd been told they could never do, were not qualified to do. And I thought, why not have a woman diver?
Was there ever a point where you thought, oh, maybe that wasn't a good idea?
No.
Okay.
I question everything. I don't want to sound overconfident. I question everything. I wondered if the whole book was a good idea. But the specific element of diving was probably one of the things about it that felt most integral, the most important. And I think part of that is that it gets back to your question about the sea. You know, the sea is one of those things that is both a literal fact and an element of life on our globe, but also sort of inherently metaphorical. I mean, try not using sea metaphors or water metaphors in your speech for 20 minutes. I dare you. We use them all the time. So there was something so rich and kind of thrilling about someone going under the water to find the mysteries and the hidden things there. That was just deeply exciting to me. Whether I could pull off a whole book set at this time with so much detailed technical knowledge in it, that was a big question for me as I worked on this.
So in the research, you consult with the first female U.S. Army deep sea diver.
Yes. Andrea Motley Crabtree is her name. And she dove in the early 80s in the Army, and she was a tremendous resource for me. Partly talking about what it was like to be the only woman in the diving world that she was part of, and she encountered a great deal of sexism, which ultimately she felt ended her career, although she was incredibly positive about diving, absolutely loved it, and as helpful to me as her descriptions of sexism and gender discrimination were her just the sensual descriptions of diving. And in particular, I remember her talking about what it felt like to dive alongside or to touch a really huge ship, the feeling that a ship was almost alive, that a sort of energy or a hum came from inside it. That description, which I use, really came from Andrea. She was a tremendous resource and just a wonderful spirit to have in my mind as I worked on this.
And you write about this in the novel, but just how physically demanding it is to be a deep sea diver.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, you have to be really fit. I mean, you're wearing a 200-pound dress. That's not really what makes it hard in that dress, while impossible on land, actually works very well underwater. It's what allows the divers to go deep. And by the time Andrea was diving, although people still trained in the Mark V or the heavy gear, of course, scuba was much more common because this was the early 80s. So she was familiar with wearing the dress, absolutely, but that wasn't what she wore a lot of the time when she dove. But it's a very strenuous physical activity, and that weeds out certain people. It also can be claustrophobic. Often visibility is very poor, so the divers really can't see what they're doing. There's the fear of, you know, not having oxygen. I mean, not every temperament can really deal with those conditions.
Was it always your thought that it would be told from multiple perspectives?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I wondered if the book might have more perspectives than I ended up with. There are three major characters, Anna, Dexter Stiles, and I write quite a bit from his point of view, the sort of gangster figure, and then Anna's father, Eddie Kerrigan, who is a longshoreman but a very disappointed man who had invested a lot in the stock market in the 20s, thought he might actually be a stockbroker and then lost everything. And so he's more part of the Irish waterfront, which was immortalized in the movie On the Waterfront, which grew out of a series of exposés in the New York newspapers about all of the corruption among the unions on the waterfront. So those are the three major characters whose minds I spend a fair amount of time in. And then I move around in and out of other sensibilities as needed, but not as much as I thought I might. With decisions like that, to have multiple points of view, the question is always, what are you giving the reader in exchange for the disruption that you're causing by moving around? And so in the end, I try to be very strict with myself about whether the payoff is worth the disruption. And that questioning nearly always results in pulling back on certain things.
Jennifer Egan is our guest. The name of the novel is Manhattan Beach. It is published by Scribner. What is it like when you are working on a novel that goes back to this time period of the 30s and 40s, and you go back to the Brooklyn Navy Yard in the present day, which looks completely different from the way it did? Can you still imagine it? Is that experience still helpful to you?
Yes, absolutely. And the Brooklyn Navy Yard has changed a great deal just in the time I've been going there, which started in about 2005. You'd be surprised how many artifacts of the war are still there. So, for example, the old railroad transom, which was where the cars were floated into the yard, is still there. It's a wreck. It's a kind of decaying, beautiful, black structure. I doubt it'll be there in 10 years, but it's there now. When I first visited the yard, buildings like the machine shop, Building 128, was basically a ruin. It was an empty, kind of ghostly place with wind washing through it. And the machines were gone, but the structure was pretty much untouched. That has now been completely renovated into a beautiful, the whole skeleton is the same, but everything has been replaced, and it's a beautiful structure. And the same with Building 77, which was the Captain of the Yards building, which had no windows except at the top. And when I went in there in about 2005, the roof had caved in. So the winter was literally pouring into the building. And there were still maps on the walls at the top of this building from World War II. Again, it's been completely renovated now. So I feel like I've really witnessed a kind of leap of the Brooklyn Navy Yard in the time that I've been going there that has in some ways moved it away from the wartime. But on the other hand, they also have now an exhibit space and a museum that really honors the history of the yard, which I helped with. I was on the advisory committee and I assisted in an oral history project of interviewing people who had worked at the yard. So while there may not be as many artifacts lying around in the yard itself, there is a kind of a taking stock of the history and a presentation of the history in Building 92, which is this exhibit space.
In your writing of the novel and realizing what the story was going to be, was it just a coincidence that it comes out as such a page-turner, almost a thriller? Or is that a conscious decision, or is that a result of the type of book you like to write?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I hope that every book I write is a page turner, because what I love as a reader, what I am always looking for above anything else, is to be just wrenched out of my daily life and pulled into a second world so that I'm living two lives and not one. And as a writer, that is what drives my doing it at all. I think that's why I love writing without a plan and just kind of seeing where the material takes me. So I'm always looking for that. I will also say, though, that I usually have some genres in mind as I'm working. And with Manhattan Beach, it was very clear to me that those genres were, one, just the noir, the kind of urban, moody, stylish, you know, there's a whole gangster part of the story. And so that, you know, that had better be somewhat thrilling. I mean, those movies were, and books, I'm thinking of people like Chandler and all kinds of pulpy fiction of the day, Rex Stout and others, you know, those are supposed to be page turners. They're supposed to be gripping. And so I hoped for that. And then the other genre that was very much in my mind and becomes pretty overt later in my book is really that of the sea survival story. Again, those are, you know, like a murder mystery, let's say. A sea survival story is one in which the stakes are instantly high. You know, we know that lives are at stake. Bad things could easily happen. Bad things probably have already happened. So that had better be a page turner. I mean, if you are writing a sea survival story and no one cares, you're doing something wrong. I mean, these are genres that are meant to grab you by the lapels and make you miss your subway stop. And that's what I'm always hoping for.
So you win the Pulitzer Prize, and what is that experience like when it comes to writing the next book? A Visit from the Goon Squad comes out, it is well received, it wins the Pulitzer, and then are you given the freedom that you wanted, that you needed before you take on the next thing?
Well, I thought that I would feel no additional pressure because I won the Pulitzer, and I kept saying that to people. But in fact, I think I did feel some additional pressure. First of all, because Goon Squad had so much good luck, I spent a lot of time promoting it. I've been doing this long enough that I know that kind of luck doesn't come twice in a career. And I did not want to look back and say, wow, why did I say no to this or that? I should have just done it when I had the chance. So I said yes, and I did it. But what that meant was that whereas normally 2 years after a book comes out, one would be well into the next book, I had not begun the next book, so I was already behind, which created a feeling of pressure. And then this particular book, Manhattan Beach, I think was really playing to my weaknesses. Since I'm bad at writing about myself and people I know and my own life, the points of connection that I've always had to between my life and the books that I've worked on tend to be times and places that I know. For example, in Goon Squad, there's a lot of stuff, just milieus from my own life, like the punk rock scene of the 70s, things like that.
Right.
Well, this time I chose a time and a place well before my lifetime. So I had no points of connection. I had to discover all of it. And that made me feel really hamstrung. And for a few years of working on this, I felt just grossly underqualified. And the result was that the work just wasn't very good. I felt it was sort of the equivalent of not speaking a language very well and trying to have a complex conversation in that language. It doesn't work. You're only able to express basic facts and only able to understand basic facts. So I felt like this book really labored under a handicap for a while, which was my own discomfort with not knowing enough about the time and place. And then very gradually, it began to get better. But during the time when I felt so incapacitated, my anxiety about doing a bad job, I think, was ratcheted up by the fact that I felt I was expected to do a great job. And those were two pretty uncomfortable years, I would have to admit.
But you never veered away from wanting to tackle the time period. You never wanted to add the technology that you had written about in your previous novels.
Well, interestingly, I had thought from the beginning that I would play around with time in a way that would let me connect more explicitly to the present moment, which would, I guess, mean technology of the present moment,
right?
Because that's one of my real obsessions. I found, to my horror, that when I tried to do that in Manhattan Beach, which I was trying to do a lot at the beginning, you know, moving around, jumping into the future, for example, which I do a lot in A Visit from the Goon Squad, all of that stuff was dead on arrival in Manhattan Beach. It fell utterly flat. And I had to let it go. It just didn't work. So I was, again, not only without a time and place that I knew, but without certain techniques that I had begun to use, I think, a bit like crutches. So I guess the answer is I was tempted to bring in the present to make myself more comfortable, but it didn't work in this book, so I had to let it all go. And I think the thing that was the most difficult for me about writing about another moment in time before I was alive, the thing that I was most deprived of was not just you know, knowing what kinds of cars people drove or cigarettes they smoked, because you can find out all that pretty quickly. But we all bring to the present moment our individual and collective pasts. And to write persuasively about people living at any moment, I have to know what they've come through. So it's not just about knowing about the 1930s and 40s in New York. It's really about having a sense of what had been happening in the city back to the late 19th century so that I understood the past of the past and not just a distant moment that I was trying to turn into the present.
Jennifer Egan's new novel is Manhattan Beach. It is published by Scribner. Jennifer Egan, what a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
My pleasure, too. Thank you.
Again, the name of the novel is Manhattan Beach by Jennifer Egan. It is published by Scribner. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.